this firsthand when I played basketball in high school. I was on the freshman beat team. My position was at the end of the bench, and in case you were wondering, no, I did not sit there the entire season. They put me in when our team was up by 30 points or more, when there was no risk of my inability to bounce the ball with one hand turning the game around. My game was soccer. My mullet didn't really look the part of a basketball player anyway. It was more of a Bon Jovi meets soccer look. Hey, my dad was a hairstylist. Instead of trying out styles on some creepy mannequin head, I let him try them out on me. The mullet was permed. I was the only guy with this look, and I think it was my secret weapon to running a successful fast break. I exchanged tips with the cheerleaders about how to minimize frizz, get more volume, and whatnot. No matter how many drills I did, how bad I wanted it, what hairstyle I was trying out, or how hard I practiced, I would never be the next Michael Jordan. He was born with a gift. So was I, but it wasn't basketball. Living in L.A., I realized something. Apart from one disastrous gig in my college years, I hadn't ever stood alone on a stage in a single tight spotlight, a mic stand in front of me, and a brick wall behind me. I needed experience, and the only place I imagined getting it was at the Comedy Store on the Sunset Strip. The Comedy Store was the very place almost every major comedian got started or cut his or her teeth. It still is the place for that. Andrew Dice Clay, Sam Kinison, Roseanne Barr, David Letterman. I wanted my name on this list, but how? You don't walk in there and introduce yourself to Mitzi Shore. The legendary proprietor who spotted and nurtured comedic genius for nearly 50 years. She had no idea who the hell I was, despite the fact that she had been sent 2 headshots from my mailings. She had total control over the lineups. Who got to perform at the club and when. If you didn't get Mitzi's stamp of approval, you would never step foot onto one of her stages. I've already sussed out that up-and-comers needed an introduction to Mitzi by someone she knew and trusted. But how was I going to arrange that? I didn't know anyone or anything in or about the comedy world in L.A. No one. Nothing. According to what I've heard, it could take years of showcases and open mics at lesser clubs, tons of networking and schmoozing before you could finagle an introduction to Mitzi. Even then, she might reject you flat out, or give you a 5-minute set on a Tuesday at 7 p.m. when not a soul was there. After 6 months in L.A., I was settled in at my job at the Four Seasons at a stable living situation. I could finally exhale, relax a bit, and turn my attention to the reason I moved out west in the first place, doing comedy, ideally at the Comedy Store. There had to be a way to speed up the approval process. I thought I found it when I learned that Sandy Shore, daughter of Mitzi and sister of Pauly, taught a class every weekend in the belly room at the Comedy Store. The belly room was the smallest of the club's 3 stages. The other 2 were the classic stand-up space in the original room and the Vegas-style showroom for headliners called the main room. The belly room was smaller, darker, initially created in the 70s by Mitzi as a female comedian's only stage. Sandra Bernhard got her start there. In the late 90s, when I arrived on the scene, it was open to all gender performances at night. On Sundays, it doubled as a classroom. The course was called Sandy Shore Sandbox. In general, I'm disgusted by sand and was turned off by the name. Sand is awkward to walk on and gets in between your toes, up your ass crack and into places you need a Q-tip to clean. And the price gave me pause. It cost $400 for 8 classes, a workbook, and videotapes of all your performances. I'd have to work 4 extra shifts at the Four Seasons to cover it, but the expense would be an investment. If I did well in class, maybe Sandy would introduce me to her mother. I'd get a shortcut to the original room. First day of the class, me and about 20 other people sat at the 2 and 4 top tables in front of the stage. Sandy, an attractive brunette, walked onto stage, looked over the class, and said, "I want to start by saying my mom and I aren't getting along right now, so if you took this class thinking that I would introduce you to her and you'd have an in at the Comedy Store, you were wrong." I thought, there goes 4 shifts. I decided to continue the course with earnest intention, to give it my best shot and hopefully learn something. Since I knew nothing about building a 10-minute act from start to finish, my skill set could only grow. From what I understand now, having met many professional comedians, taking a course is not the typical way to break in. When I tell people about it, they laugh at me and say, "What? You took a class?" I sure as hell did, and you know what? It was a supportive environment with a lot of big-hearted people who were just trying to get better at making people laugh, too. I was happy to spend my Sundays with them. Every week, each one of us would get on stage and perform jokes we'd come up with in the interim, like a mini-set, and we have a group discussion about it. Not a critique, per se, just a conversation, what worked and what didn't. I would describe the tone as encouraging, but honest. Even if a guy bombed week after week, we would find something positive to say about his act. I don't know how seriously all the other students were about a career in comedy or whether they would have preferred harsher critiques. For me, it was all about the practice and the positive feedback. In the real world, doing open mics at bowling alleys, you'd get plenty of criticism and negativity. But in the sandbox, it was all about building confidence. At the end of the class, Sandy gave us a homework assignment from her workbook called Secrets to Stand-Up Success. It was a manual about generating material, inventing a stage persona, and writing premise, segue, punchline combos, one-line visuals, and callbacks. In the first chapter, we were to plumb the depths of our personal histories for topics by answering questions like, what was the worst experience you ever had with your mom? What was the worst experience you've ever had with your dad? Do you have any phobias? What are your 3 biggest fears? What was your worst nightmare? What do you feel guilty about? I remember thinking, is this a comedy class or a therapy session? I didn't like to think about any of this stuff at all, much less talk about it in front of strangers. As I developed my act over the years and figured things out about myself, I would touch on a lot of this same subject matter. But at the time, I wouldn't go near it. I skipped the dark questions and stuck with the softer ones, like, if you could be anything in the world right now, what would you be? Easy. A comedian who performs at your mother's club. Another exercise was to figure out what type of comedian I would be. The choices were sarcastic, like Louis Black, egocentric, Andrew Dice Clay, underdog, Rodney Dangerfield, victim, Larry David, Gary Shandling, shy, reserved, Ellen DeGeneres, Stephen Wright, opinionated, Bill Maher, observational, George Carlin, Jerry Seinfeld. I didn't do politics, still don't. You have to know your shit inside and out for that, and I wasn't even close. I was opinionated and an observer, so I decided to be an opinionated observer. Already breaking new ground and inventing my own type. And it was only week 2. I pored over the assignments and prepared for class. It was the only homework I ever enjoyed doing. I read things I wrote and would go, wow, where did that come from? I'd get an idea which would jog a memory and I'd think, I could branch off and take that further. My mind was often running, or at least jogging, around the block doing these assignments. The best part was watching my set on video each week. I'd watch other students' performance once, and then I'd just fast-forward past those and would study mine over and over again to judge for myself how I was doing. I wasn't going to get raw, brutal honesty from other students. So I'd have to be my own harshest critic to figure out what went wrong and right. I had two measures of success for a new bit. Laughter equals working. No laughter equals not working. I kept detailed records of every laugh I got on the videos, expanded on the good stuff, and cut everything else out. Nowadays, I have a more finely calibrated measure of a set success, which could seem mysterious to other people. I'm looking for a feeling from the people in the audience, an energy that passes from me to them and from them back to me. That feeling is the true measure of a joke's worth. A laugh is kind of cheap. It's what audience want to do. It's what they expect to do. But if I feel an inaudible emotional locking in that tells me my set is working, it's almost like music, like a rhythm I could speed up or slow down. And if the audience is right there with me, I could take them anywhere I want. I feel in control, no nerves, no worries, just a synchronized flow. It's the greatest feeling in the world. Now something not working is a feeling of disconnect. I might be making the audience laugh, people might be doubled over, but as a performer, if I don't feel the energy linking me and the people, I think, shit, something's off here. What goes wrong can be subtle, but the effect is obvious to me, and it sucks. It feels like I'm completely alone up there. Back in my Sandy's sandbox days, though, I had no idea about the energy, the flow, interacting on an invisible level with the audience. I was just trying to crack people up, and I was succeeding. As the weeks went by, I started to notice when I went up and did my set, people were laughing more than when the others did theirs. Sometimes you don't know how good you are until you're holding yourself up in comparison to other people at your level. Unlike just-for-fun students, I was dead serious about comedy as a career. I wasn't doing this class for nothing, and I worked a lot harder on my set than most others. The effort showed. I started to feel the same I have it confidence I'd gotten in fourth grade doing my book report, ripping one another with my friends, and at the kitchen table at home. Something good was happening here. The last day of the course was a big showcase where we would perform our best material for a room full of family, friends, and a committee of professional comedians that Sandy brought in. I invited some people from the Four Seasons to cheer me on, and I was grateful that they came and would continue to come for other open mics and gigs for the next 7 years. I killed. I got the biggest laughs by far, and I mingled in the crowd afterward with a serious swag. And then my bubble burst. A comedian friend of Sandy came up to me and said, "I was turned off by your anger. It was forced and unnatural. You need to work on finding your authentic voice." I was open to this constructive criticism. When I went home, I studied the tapes with this new perspective and realized she was right. I noticed the anger was masking my insecurities, and that I needed to dig deeper, find the truth within myself, and be real instead of putting on this fake facade. Yeah, comedy is like therapy after all. I'd watched myself on those weekly tapes 100 times, and I hadn't picked up on what this comedian noticed in 2 seconds. So much for being my own harshest critic. A lot of comedians say that their sense of humor comes from pain, that stand-ups are generally troubled souls, and we are a breed apart with a different mindset than most people. I relate to always feeling like I see things about the world that others don't, but I can't say where my skewed perspective came from. Not pain and suffering. My family was middle class. My parents were loving, healthy people. No addictions, no abuse, no depressions, no jail time. We all have our ups and downs in life, but I'm generally a stable guy. There are days that I might not be as happy as others, but my comedy has always been inspired by a love of making people laugh. That drive comes straight from all those happy nights around the kitchen table growing up. When I face painful things like my grandfather's Alzheimer's or my parents' divorce after 38 years of marriage, I don't talk about it, on stage or off, for a while. I let it settle. My first gut reaction is, I don't think this is funny at all. Then, a year or two down the road, I talk about it more and more. I open up about it, how I really feel, and the jokes just pop out. Like recently, my newly single 70-year-old mom told me she's gone on ItalianMeat.com. I said, "Ma, I hope that's spelled M-E-E-T." Suddenly, what was once upsetting is funny again, and then it goes into the act. Someone once said that comedy is tragedy plus time. I think for me, comedy is agony plus time. I agonized as a kid, but there was no tragedy to speak of. When I started out, I directed my angst outward. I had a look-at-this-guy point of view, reacting with disgust and disdain at the bad behavior of others. I did have to deal with a lot of crap at work, rude, offensive, obnoxious customers, but I didn't want to talk about the Windows Lounge on stage. I thought I'd come off like a whiny waiter, which is not funny to anyone. I didn't realize for years to come that the topics I didn't talk about on stage then were the very funny ones that truly upset and disturbed me. So what disturbed me the most about the Four Seasons? Nuts. In a golden caddy with three sections. As a rule, I brought out a full nut caddy to each table. Then, I'd have to replenish it on demand, over and over again. People would come in, order a seltzer or hot water with lemon, take up a table in my section, and polish off seven trays of the nuts. We were required to refill the olive dish, too. They'd slurp down a trough worth of black olives, litter the pits like spitballs, drip the juice all over the tablecloth, and ask me to fetch more. They'd always call it some stupid name like, "Can I have some more snackies?" They thought all three snacks were an appetizer, entree, and dessert. No, they were just something salty to make them thirsty for drinks, not an all-you-can-eat buffet. This nuisance really got under my skin. These people would signal me with hand gestures from across the room, pointing at their nut dish, twirling a finger like, "Another round of freebies." I'd say, "Of course," while keeping what I wanted to say in my head. "Sir, not sure if you're aware, but there are 800 calories per snacky. So you may want to get a larger size of pants or take this pair to the alterations lady because your button is about to snap off." Sometimes people ask for the ingredients in the dish. I'd have to smile and say, "Nuts and salt." I can't stand it when I'm having dinner out and someone at my table asks the waiter to list every ingredient in the dish and where it came from. I never ask. I just eat. My wife is one of those people. She orders off the menu, which drives me crazy. If the waiter doesn't know, he has to go back to the kitchen and find out. It holds up the whole ordering process. When I was at the Four Seasons and someone asked me the ingredients in the dressing of, say, the heirloom tomato salad, and I didn't know the answer, I'd lean forward slightly and say, "It's not very good." I'd bypass the entire discussion. Free snacks didn't add to their bill, so my tip would be nothing. But I'd have to run back and forth refilling the caddy, pouring their hot water, changing their soiled tablecloths for nothing. And these cheap bastards looked down on me because I was a server. How was I supposed to pay my rent if all these looky-loos parked themselves at a table and stared at celebs and didn't order anything? Wow, was I angry. Could this be an anger that was rearing its head during my Sandy showcase? I was frustrated that I wasn't on the other side of the table or behind the wheel of a Mercedes-Benz. But this emotion inspired me to be in that position one day. I learned to turn the frustration into motivation, or else it would eat me away. You have to find it where you can. I've always loved to discover motivational people. Now I blast Dr. Eric Thomas, the hip-hop preacher, to get my day started outright. Back then, I'd watch documentaries about success stories on TV. I knew I'd get where I wanted to go one day, and when I got there, I would not stuff my face with the free nuts, and if I did, I'd leave a generous tip for the waiter. A common misconception about stand-up. It's the same thing as hanging out in a bar with your friends, telling stories, and trash-talking each other. The truth is, stand-up is nothing like that at all. You're not on a bar stool with your buddies. You're on a stage in front of a number of strangers. They don't know you, your history, or who you really are, and you don't reveal your true self to them. You are not yourself up there. You're a comedian doing an act. A lot of comics create shtick, a gimmick, or a persona to do on stage. For me, the angry guy was a persona I tried on. I didn't want to be that guy in real life, but it came out on stage anyway. I was uncomfortable with it, and in turn, it made the audience, or at least the one comedian at my graduation showcase, uncomfortable too. For many comedians, it takes years of peeling away their early fake personas to become that real person on stage. It's terrifying to expose yourself like that, which is why it takes a while. But you have to do it in order to really connect with the people. When I roll the Angry Guy tapes now, man, I can't even watch. They make me cringe. One bit I did then was to arrange for one of my classmates' phones to go off in the middle of my performance and then pretend like he had answered the call and proceeded to have the conversation. Then my joke was to become enraged, rush into the audience, take the phone away, yelling and going ballistic. It was terrible. It's hard to watch. It's so not me. I'm not a rage guy. I'm the guy who spritzes himself with cologne every morning. I'm the guy who irons his underwear. Why was I acting like a baboon on steroids? It's so hard in the beginning of stand-up to just be as authentic as possible. You're uncomfortable under the lights. Everybody's looking at you. You don't know if people are going to take your act right or the wrong way. It wasn't until 5 or 6 years ago when I started talking about my family that I noticed a huge change in the audience response to me. People liked the raw honesty far more than the anger and outrage. I could have never opened up like that in the beginning. As I said, I was angry when I took the course. Those fucking almonds. But I'm not the angry guy. I had to learn to see the distinction. Anger is a loud emotion. My act then was high volume. I was living with quieter emotions, too, like insecurity, doubt, loneliness, frustration, vulnerability, things that, at the time, were way too private to share. I was only 24 years old, and as I have said, I didn't know jack shit about anything. I wanted to come off as mysterious, the guy who made people wonder, who is he? What isn't he telling us? What's he thinking? In hindsight, their guess was as good as mine. I signed up for another 8-week comedy course, and another, and I played in Sandy Shore's sandbox every weekend for 6 months. Performing was practice. I was like, okay, sign me up for another class because I have to keep myself writing and stay motivated. You're probably wondering if my half a year in comedy school translated to any real-world gigs. Did I ever meet Mitzi Shore? I did meet Mitzi, but that's another story. And no, I didn't get one single gig as a direct result of the course. Neither did any of the other classmates. To my knowledge, no one I took the course with has gone on to be a professional comedian. The one guy I thought was the funniest in the class gave it a good shot, but he quit after a few years. I recently ran into the guy. He was managing a perfume counter at Barney's Beverly Hills. Come to think of it, I'm due for a new scent. I think I'll go see him. I had no regrets about the time and money investment, though. Technically, I had been doing stand-up at the Comedy Store for 6 months. My marketing mind kicked in. I took the VHS of the final showcase set, not as angry as the first, had a bunch of copies made, and put the Comedy Store logo on the clamshell box it came in. I added a headline, Sebastian Maniscalco, live at the Comedy Store, along with my phone number. I now had a nicely packaged tape to send out to agents, casting directors, and club owners. And I did. One of the places I sent it was the Ice House Comedy Club in Pasadena. I got a letter back, which I've since framed. It said I wasn't ready or seasoned enough to play the venue. If you get a letter like that, you could either get discouraged and quit, or you could stay motivated and believe that one day you'll make it. So I kept it. And I used it to spur me on and to never give up. Fast forward 17 years, in 2015, I performed 5 shows at the Ice House. The owner, not the letter writer, came up on stage and said, I've only done this with a few other comedians, and this guy is really talented. He's special. Then he gave me a bottle of Dom for selling out all of those shows. It's a nice touch. It was a real moment of validation for me. I knew that I'd come full circle at that performance. So comedy can be taught? It took me 17 years of practice and peeling away the mask to be able to stand center stage and feel comfortable and relaxed, as if I were at the kitchen table with my family and friends. I did not learn that in the classroom. So my answer would have to be no, good comedy can't be taught. It takes experience, which could only be endured. Chapter 3. Two Drink Minimum. Ever since I was 10, we sat down to dinner. My father's first and second questions were, "What'd you do today?" "Nothing." If I was off that day, I would immediately have to exaggerate mundane activities to make it sound like I'd done a lot. "Yeah, Dad, I brushed my teeth, top and bottom, put my shoes on the right feet, and had a lunch meeting." He will never stop working. He'll die standing behind the stylist chair in his salon doing a dye job. He'll be folding some woman's hair into tinfoil and he'll just collapse face first into the bleach bowl. In our house, it wasn't enough that he work like a man possessed. Everyone else had to as well. I started working young, going door to door in my neighborhood mowing lawns. I shared 3 lawns with my across-the-street neighbor, John Papadia, you know, the bozo guy. He was older and would manipulate me into doing more of the work, but we'd split the money evenly. What I had made hardly covered my bills for my medication, which I had to take because I was allergic to grass and ragweed. I was also using my father's lawnmower, which wasn't borrowed. I had to rent it, tune it, replace parts, and pay for gas. One year I had to replace a blade after mowing lawn that was so long that I ran over a hornet's nest. There's nothing worse than running down shag bark lane wearing a medical mask while being chased by killer insects. If my father caught me, say, sitting, he'd tell me to go stain the fence or reshingle the roof. At age 6. I don't know any other way to live. His work ethic is so deeply ingrained, I feel empty on my rare days off. My wife says, "Relax." But I have to at least skim the pool or change some light bulbs. I can't help myself. When I turned 14, I was old enough to get a permit to start working an hourly wage at a legit business. I've worked like a mule, one job or another, 2 or 3 at a time ever since. I was a busboy at Fuddruckers at 14. I was so conscientious, I was promoted to fry guy at 15. I took pride in making the perfect crispy golden fries. After that, I was promoted to cashier, the highest honor before becoming a manager. For Olin Mills Portrait Studio, I cold-called people to sell them portrait packages and somehow convinced perfect strangers to give me their credit card information. If they didn't want to do that over the phone, I would send over our delivery guy, John, me, to their house to pick up the check or cash. During college summers, I temped at an insurance agency, filing, making copies. The only difference between this job and solitary confinement was the endless Manila folders. I'm still wondering if Manila is the color or the type of folder. You know your job is boring when you try to guess the time before looking at the clock, and it's 4 hours earlier than you thought. Holiday breaks, I would work at Honey Baked Ham glazing ham and turkeys. I wore white coveralls, a hairnet, a hard hat over that, white industrial gloves up to my elbows, and goggles, like I was about to assemble microchips. In case you don't know, and I hope you don't, how to glaze ham, you baste it with honey and then blast it with a blowtorch. The number one job requirement, don't set yourself on fire. Number two, don't burn the building down. I came home every day covered in sweat and smelling like a hog. I would have to take 2 showers, scrub myself with industrial soap, and then still stink. But I was proud because the worse the smell, the better. It was proof to my father that I put in hard time. On Mother's Day, Father's Day, Halloween, any holiday that might inspire a party, my college roommates and I worked as banquet servers at the Hilton Hotel with a bunch of older ladies whose sole purpose was to secure for themselves the best coffee pots, the ones that actually worked. that kept the coffee hot and didn't leak before the rest of us arrived. To get a good pot, we had to grease the palm of my friend Steve's mother, who worked the shift before us. I waited tables in high-end and low-rent places. Let me tell you the story about the Olive Garden. Yes, I worked there. And it's a cardinal sin, deep embarrassment for an Italian. When I told my father I was working there, he didn't get it. He was so proud, as he told me that he'd also farmed olives as a little boy in Sicily. I had to break it to him that the Olive Garden was not farm to table. It was freezer to fork. The waiters were required to sing this special birthday song. I remember it going, "From the pasta we make to the lasagna we bake, mystery lyric that no one knows, we're wishing you a happy birthday. We hope you will remember this fine event forever. We're wishing you a happy birthday." It's like family and friends at the Olive Garden in the true Italiano way. Hey, hey. So if you're looking for some fun, try a Hospitaliano. Have a happy, happy day. Hey. There was nothing worse than trying to round up your fellow gardeners to form the house band to sing this song. Problem was, everybody was too busy giving tables their fourth and fifth round of free salad and breadsticks. So, I would have to go to the table alone. That's right. I'd have to sing solo a cappella. Not only can I not carry a tune, I didn't know all the words, and I would mumble and clap loudly over the parts I didn't know. The saving grace was that most of the customers were just trying to cover up the fact that it really wasn't their birthday, and just to get to the part where they got the complimentary cake. I often thought that desserts at restaurants were only for birthdays or apologies for the order fuck-ups, as in, "Sorry we burned your steak. Here's a complimentary chocolate chip cookie for the inconvenience." And for God's sake, I was Captain Morgan, fully dressed with a parrot on my shoulder. I made appearances at all sorts of venues. At a biker bar, I'd have to take my regalia in and change in the bathroom. If those guys saw me come through the front door in my costume, my parrot and or hook would have been shoved up my ass in a matter of seconds. Another night, I got booked at a bar where all my friends were going. I tried to disguise myself and drown out my real voice with my best pirate accent. My friends were relentless, and by the end of the night, I had no parrot, no hook, and they had stolen all my sample shots. I showed up at every job interview, even for the lowly banquet waiter, in a suit and tie. It often looked like I was the one conducting the interview, and the guy doing the hiring was trying to get the job. For me, the work ethic extended to appearance. I had to look good as a matter of principle to be taken seriously. Why was I so driven? I worked all these jobs, the good, the bad, and the smelly, to keep my father off my back and to make money, of course. I had rent to pay. Even at my father's house, in high school and college, having my own money meant I didn't have to ask my parents for cash to buy a nice bottle of Dracar Noir cologne, a new pair of Cavarici pants, or an Italian beef sandwich from my favorite place, Johnny's Beef on Arlington Heights Road. I may come from a middle-class family, but I've always had a taste for a good meal and a well-tailored jacket. I'd rather drive a 1999 Honda in a Hugo Boss suit than wear tattered jeans and a stained T-shirt in a Mercedes-Benz. Which was a good thing back then, since a Mercedes-Benz wasn't about to magically appear in my driveway anytime soon. During college at Northern Illinois University, I won a stand-up comedy contest, and the prize was opening for a headliner at a venue near campus. Apart from my parents, everybody else in the audience was black. I went up there, introduced myself, paced the stage, and said something that was meant to be funny. Total silence. I mean, deep space quiet. I kept going with my largely unformed act. It was pre-sandbox, pre-comedy store. I didn't even know what a set was. I got nothing. No laughter. Some people coughed. A few groaned audibly as if in pain. I was so grateful because coughs and groans were better than complete silence. You know, I'm the type of sweater where it's not like a slight dew on my brow. It's more like Niagara Falls. Once the sweat breaks, the floodgates are open. There's no hiding it. I still had 9.5 minutes to go. By the end of the set, I looked like the coach of the winning team at the Super Bowl who was drenched in Gatorade. I was about 2 minutes in when somebody shouted what sounded like the word Sandman. Others in the crowd laughed at that. And then more of them started saying it, too. It evolved into a chant like, Sandman! 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 Sandman? Like I was putting them to sleep? In a moment of pure, wild optimism, I thought they might be chanting, Sebastian! Sebastian! Somehow, I got to the end of my time, and I was chased off the stage by a full audience chorus of shouted Sandmans. I immediately asked myself, who or what the hell is Sandman, and why are they screaming his name at me? The next day, I went to the library and I did some research. I got an answer. As it turns out, a man named Howard Sandman Sims, a legendary tap dancer, used to pour sand on the stage at the iconic Apollo Theater in Harlem and tap dance on it, hence the name Sandman. But the Sandman was also known by another handle. The Executioner. For decades at the Apollo, when a performer bombed, the crowd would scream and boo and shout, Sandman. That was Howard Sims' cue to tap dance on stage, sometimes brandishing a toy pistol, and literally chase the performer into the wings. Shouting Sandman instead of, say, the traditional white redneck tradition, you suck, get off the frickin' stage, became a thing for black audience at the Apollo and elsewhere, including comedy clubs outside Chicago in the 90s. As I read more about him, I realize what an incredible, resilient performer Sims was. He died at 86 in 2003. His first time at the Apollo, he entered a dancing contest and was kicked off the stage. Same thing for his second and third times. For 10 consecutive times, he was booted. But the 11th time, he won the contest. And the 12th, and the 13th. Sims won 25 times in a row. He won so many times, the Apollo declared him the official all-time champion and established a 4-win limit for all future competitors. This guy didn't know how to quit. Once I read that incredible story, I felt proud of my Sandmanning. I started to chant Sandman in my head whenever I felt panicked on stage, to remind myself to keep on going. If I could be like Howard Sims, who never quit, who never gave up, maybe one day people would chant Sebastian when I appeared on stage. Flash forward a bunch of years, and the Sebastian chant has been known to happen. I've been extremely fortunate to have fans that get my sense of humor and relate to it. These people get me. I can just give a look to get my people laughing. I also really get into doing comedy for people who don't get me and won't necessarily relate to my stories about growing up Italian in Chicago. For a long time, every Tuesday night, I performed in black rooms in L.A. It's not like I was trying to relive my college-era sweat shower experience. I just appreciated the honesty of the audience. If you sucked, you got nothing. No sympathy laughs. But if they would come around and love you, it was gratifying as hell. My subject matter doesn't change depending on venue or audience. I do the same set in front of a black crowd that I would do in, say, Scottsdale, Arizona. When it comes down to it, wherever you're from, whatever your background, you'll find something familiar in a genuine act, something to sink your teeth into. I thrive on the challenge of taking a room full of strangers who haven't seen my prior specials, have no idea what my comedy is about, and getting laughs. It's an incredible high when I pull it off. Otherwise, it's a sweat shower. I met a good friend of mine, Brett Paul, on my first day of class at the Comedy Store. I was shocked to learn that he was an executive at Warner Brothers Television, very high up on the totem pole there. Why would a guy with show business clout be in the sandbox with a know-nothing like me? For him, It was just a hobby, just something to do on Sunday. He was very funny, though, with belly laugh moments on stage. The one guy I really enjoyed watching. We hit it off, and at the end of the course, I thought, now we could go out and do some stand-up together. I knew a place, Highland Grounds, a club on Highland Avenue in L.A., that had an open mic night that started at 10 p.m. I said to Brett, let's do it. He said, I can't. Come on, man, it'll be fun. Sebastian, I got a job. Oh, yeah, he was a hot shit lawyer at a major production company. You have to do this at least once, I said, and kept at him until he agreed to go with me. I didn't want to do it myself. I needed one person in the audience to laugh at my jokes. Highland Grounds was open mic night for everything. Musicians, comedians, singers, jugglers. Not specifically for stand-up. Brett and I showed up at 10 p.m. He was already yawning. And we waited in the back for an hour and a half watching a bunch of awful performers. Finally, it was our turn. He went up first and did his act. I looked around and realized I was the only one paying any attention. All the other people were tuning their guitars, practicing their plate spinning, warming up harmonicas, waiting for their turn. I got up and I went straight into my act. I stuck to the script, no improv, no catering to the crowd, which equaled no laughs. No one bothered to respond or seemed aware I'd spoken at all. Did anyone show up just to watch the show? As soon as I had the thought, I swear to God, I heard someone doing voice warm-ups in the back of the room. La 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 la, la 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 la. To do comedy, you need an audience. Otherwise, you're just making jokes in a dark room. Don't get me wrong. I've been known to crack myself up on occasion, but there's no way to know if what you think is funny is also funny to others unless you put yourself out there. At Highland Grounds, I was way out there. But as far as the audience was concerned, I was invisible. From his seat in the back, Brett smiled gamingly at me. It felt like I was only performing for him. I thought, okay, they're not listening now, but as soon as that guy stops tuning his ukulele, they're all going to pay attention. With grit and determination, I dug into my set, really getting into it, acing my premises and my setups, nailing my punchlines. If Sandy Shore would have been in the audience, she would have been proud. And wouldn't you know it, everyone in the place continued to completely ignore me. Yeah, this is not one of those stories where people suddenly tune in and say, whoa, who is this guy? He's really great. Nope. I don't have any of those stories for you at Highland Grounds open mic. You could have been Chris Rock or Dice Clay. No one would have looked at you twice. On the drive home, Brett said, I'm never doing that again. Can't say I blamed him. Brett reached his limit after just one demoralizing night. I had to ask myself, how many am I up for? My father's voice was always in the back of my head. You don't know what hard work is. Nothing ever comes easy for us Maniscalcos. I told myself that my hard limit of demoralizing nights was infinity. I would keep on doing this night after night, three times a night, forever, before I admitted defeat. It wasn't about winning. For me, the ultimate victory would be to earn a living doing one thing I love most, stand-up comedy. I was never doing it for wealth or fame. I just loved comedy, and I had been raised to equate quitting with death. It wasn't like an I'll show them thing, although I did want to make my parents proud. It was a feeling of never being a person who gave up too soon and let his dream slip away. Ironically named, Highland Grounds was a low point, but it was also symbolic. I was starting at the bottom and had nowhere to go but up. From that night on, if there was an open mic anywhere in L.A., I'd be in the back of the room waiting for my turn to stand in front of it. While the other comedians were comparing notes and bragging about how their set killed at a comedy room at Miyagi's, sushi, or Michelli's, Italian, the night before, I would isolate myself from them all. I'd study the crowd. I'd go over my notes before it was time to go on. I did hundreds of bringer shows where you had to bring in a certain amount of people to get a spot on stage and do your set for free. The way it worked, I would give the promoter a list of six or seven names of people I had coming. I'd make sure they all checked in at the front door. Even more awkward than being ignored on stage was the weekly task of asking friends, co-workers at the Four Seasons, anyone I met to come see me perform. It was a big ask. I hated doing it. Roping someone into seeing your comedy show isn't like asking them to sign a petition or write a Yelp review. They had to give up a free night, drive across town, pay for gas, parking, a cover charge, a two-drink minimum, and sit through 12 other comedians until I did my act, which at the time was kind of painful to watch. My soft sell went something like, "Hey, Katie, I'm doing stand-up at Lucky Strike Bowling Alley tonight. If you want to come, let me know." Katie would say, "What? A bowling alley? Boxing ring, veteran hall, strip club? You could do comedy there?" "Yeah, it's really great," I'd say. "You never know who's going to be there. It's right in Hollywood, so there might be someone in the industry in there. It's a little hard to hear over the crashing of the bowling pins, but I get a free round of bowling, so we could hit the lanes afterwards." I never pushed it. I never begged or even explained that if I didn't get the requisite number of bodies with a pulse and cash, I wouldn't get to perform at all. I just told people about the show, and because they liked me or thought I was funny already, a lot of the times they would come. I would only ask the same person twice, though. After that, it gets awkward. Before long, you run out of people to ask. I convinced the general manager of the Four Seasons, an Englishman, to come out one night. I don't think he understood why I was even doing stand-up.
"But you work here," he said.
He was a hotel guy, and he just didn't get why I and 70% of his staff were pursuing other things while waiting tables or parking cars to pay their rent. But he was game and he came to the show. I think he was curious how a serious cocktail waitress could possibly tell a joke and make a crowd of people laugh. Years later, when my stand-up career picked up, every time I saw him around the hotel, he'd ask in this condescending British voice, "Are you still doing comedy?" And then I imagine asking him, "Do you still think I want to serve lemon drop martinis for the rest of my life?" After 2 years of open mics, playing to sparse crowds and sometimes no crowds, I developed a solid 10 to 15 minutes of material. I knew I had some good stuff because I was making waiters, busboys, and other comedians laugh. It was time to reach out for a better class of venue. The Comedy Store had an open mic night, too, on Sundays between 7 and 9 p.m. It wasn't like you could just show up with five friends and go on. There was a system in place. All first-timers were to come to the store on Sunday afternoon, along with 50 other comedians, to pick a slip of paper literally out of a hat. Most of the slips were blank, but 20 of them had a number on them. If you picked a number, it meant that you would do 3 minutes at the following Sunday night's open mic. The number itself was the order of when you would go on. So, if you picked number 1, you'd go on first. If you picked 20, you'd go on last. I went to the lottery every week and waited outside in the parking lot for 5 to 6 hours to put my hand in that hat. And then I got the blank slips for weeks in a row. Back then, there was only 2-hour parking by the Comedy Store. So, I would have to keep running back and forth to my car to put money in the meter. At that time, a parking ticket could set me back for weeks. I kept returning every Sunday regardless. Sooner or later, I told myself my number was going to come up. And it did. I got number 15, meaning I would be the 15th comedian to perform the following Sunday. So I could expect to go on stage around 8:30 p.m. And this was good. The later you went on, the more people were in the room, including the paid regulars. They started showing up at the tail end of the open mic hours to have a drink or two and hang out with their friends before they did their sets at 9. Everyone knew that if you could get a regular to laugh, he or she might recommend you to do a showcase for Mitzi Shore. And then if she really liked you, she'd put you on the paid roster. I spent the week before my open mic slot polishing my material. Then, after what I felt like was forever, Sunday came around. I went to the Comedy Store, squeezed inside, and waited in the back for the 14 comedians before me to finish. Finally, I heard the MC, Bob Oshak, call my name. With my black Liz Claiborne suit and light blue button-down shirt, I marched my cheesy ass onto the stage and did my 3 minutes. Shortest 3 minutes in my life. I'd built up so much in my mind with so much adrenaline anticipation, and then it was over before my brain processed that it was actually happening. But at least I didn't freeze. I think I did well. People seemed to like it, but I wasn't sure. I got off stage and the next guy went up, and I remember walking to the back of the room to catch my breath. A bear of a guy ambled over to me and indicated with a head wag to step outside. I did, and he followed. Once we were outside, he extended his hand and said, "I'm Wheels. I like what you're doing up there. I'm going to recommend you to Mitzi." Just like that, Michael Wheels Parisi, Comedy Store regular and longtime member of the Andrew Dice Clay Posse, became my sponsor. He set me up to do a showcase for Mitzi Shore. Mitzi wasn't at the club too often in those days because she was dealing with some health issues, but she did come in for an hour showcase once a week. So I was one of a small group of aspiring comedians who got on stage and did 3 minutes for her while she sat in the back of the room. Seeing her for the first time, I'll never forget the presence she had. If her aura could talk, it would say, "Do not speak unless spoken to." Mitzi is the Anna Wintour of comedy. With her go-ahead, I did the same 3 minutes I'd done at the open mic. Afterwards, she called me over with the wave of her hand. I stood in front of her, ready to thank her for the opportunity and gush like a polite Italian boy. But she didn't give me the chance. Before I could speak, she said, "I want to see you do 10 minutes. It was like a callback. I went back to the next showcase, and I did my 10-minute set. As I walked off stage, she said, "How long are you in town?" I was surprised by her question. I didn't know how to answer. I was afraid if I said I lived there, she'd say, "Pack your suitcase and go back home." If I said I didn't live there, she'd say, "Don't bother moving out here." I said, "I live in Hollywood." "Okay." And that was the end of the conversation. I was dismissed. I walked out of there thinking, the fuck did that mean? The next day, to my disbelief, I get a call from the store's talent coordinator who informed me that I've been upgraded to the pay regular status, and I could call in for spots at the Comedy Store and earn $15 per 15-minute set. $1 a minute. I was making $60 per hour, which was a better rate than I was making at the Four Seasons. Of course, you don't get four sets an hour, 8 hours a day at the store. You're lucky you get one set. I wasn't doing it for the money. That would have been insane. But I was starving for stage time, especially that stage. Every night, I called in and said, "I'll take any available slot." My reasoning was the more slots I put in for, the more I'd get. But every comedian did that. Mitzi was really generous in the beginning, giving me 3, sometimes 4 spots a week, which was a good amount of time for me to hone my act. Once I had my slots at the store, I would work out how I was going to manipulate my Four Seasons schedules to get there. With my seniority, I'd been there for a few years by then, I was able to race to the Comedy Store and do a 15-minute set during my 45-minute break. This is how it worked. Exactly 1 hour before my slot, I would survey my tables and refill everybody's drink, water, and nut caddy. 2, I would use the bar's landline to call the store and ask if they were on schedule, while pretending like I was taking a phone order. Often the store's schedule was off because someone like Eddie Griffin had popped in to do a set. When a famous comedian popped in, he or she went on stage immediately for as long as the comedian would like, throwing the entire night's schedule off. Funny that's called a set when the time is fluid.
3. If they were on time, I would leave the Four Seasons 10 minutes before my start time at the store. 4. I would drive over there in 8 minutes flat. I was like the Waze app before it existed. At stoplights, I'd change out of my waiter uniform into nice slacks. I threw on a show shirt I had picked up on the part of Melrose nobody should go. The clothing store had to be a front for drugs and laundered money. I was the only asshole purchasing the see-through snakeskin button-downs in the Attitudes for Men window display. If the stoplights didn't allow me to change, I would wear my Four Seasons uniform on stage. One time, when I was waiting to go up, someone asked me to get them a Midori Sour. I had left my name tag on. 5. After the set ended, I'd race back in time to clock in again and not get into trouble with the hotel manager. I spent as much time in the car going back and forth to the store as I did on stage, but it was worth it. I made the Comedy Store my home base, and it still is to this day. I was doing other shows at other clubs, too. The more I worked, the more opportunities I'd find. Just by bouncing around, I started meeting people in the comedy community. Someone might see my act and say, "Hey, I got a show in the back room of a restaurant. You should come by." And I would. Pay, no pay, I didn't care. I could pay for my life with the money I was making at the Windows Lounge. My pay for comedy was stage time, honing my craft, and learning the beats and the ins and outs of stand-up. If the show was in the back room of a restaurant, I tried the food. Not for free. Nothing was handed to me for free, ever. But as you know, I'm perpetually starving. And if I saw a plate of ribs go by, I'd have to place an order for myself. But always after the show. I learned this early on in my career. One time I had a little Zupa Depeche before a set. It really throws off your timing if you're trying to tell jokes between burping up clams and garlic. I never ran or organized a comedy show, not my skill set. But I became known as a guy who would do other people's shows at the drop of a hat. Along with the Comedy Store slots, I was up to 10 sets a week. Only a few years in, it seemed like I was right on path and making some headway. I was also starting to feel happy with what I was doing on stage. My act was evolving away from that angry guy and into the appalled guy. A subtle but seismic shift. I wasn't pissed off anymore. Just incredulous about the bad behaviors of others. I cultivated the attitude, started to get the beats, more physical, more animated up there. I came up with 3 minutes about raw stress for less, which became my signature bit. What to, raw stress for less? Anybody been to this nightmare? I went in there, I thought I walked into downtown Beirut. I thought a bomb went off. Everything was on the floor. How are they shopping over there? What are they pulling stuff off the shelf saying, "Nah, this is not my size," and then I'd throw it across the room. I heard they had cheap jeans over there. So I'm in this store shopping. I found a pair. In housewares. If you're lucky enough to become known for a certain bit, and you do it enough times, people start to associate you with the bit. People started coming up to me before I went up at shows saying, "You're the Ross Dress for Less guy. Could you please do that bit tonight?" I met comedian Brett Ernst at the Hustler Hollywood sex shop, just doing some casual shopping. Just kidding. Though maybe he was. Even the Hustler Club had a comedy night. They also had a coffee shop called Hustler Hollywood Cafe, and that made for a tasty brew that was sure to get you up. They had a secret ingredient. I think it was heavy cream. So Brett and I were both doing the Hustler comedy night. And we chatted on the sidewalk outside. I gave him my card with a photo of me on it, a pager in one hand and a cell phone in the other, with the tagline, "You gonna page me?" and my number. I could have just said Sebastian Maniscalco comedian, but I had to put my stamp on it. Brett looked at the card with the expression like, "What a dickhead,"